That's 519-821-0270.
Hey, how you doing? My radio name is Mac D, and I've been hanging around CFRU for a long, long time because it's fun. I started off working the equipment, producing shows, and then moved into doing my own show. Along the way, I've learned about local artists and their music, and other artists and music I never would have heard of or listened to before. I'm still here, still doing shows, still having fun. If what I do sounds like something you'd enjoy, visit us on the second floor of the University Center and find out what CFRU has to offer you.
CFRU's Raise Your Voice fundraising drive has been a yearly tradition at the station for many decades now. As a not-for-profit organization, CFRU strongly relies on the support of our community members, and we are incredibly thankful for the generosity shown by the Guelph community during our funding drives and beyond. We have decided that going forward, we are only going to hold funding drives when we have an initiative or goal that we absolutely would not be able to achieve without the support of our membership. As such, CFRU will not be holding a funding drive this year. Our goal is to instead be out in the community more often, engaging with our audiences more directly through remote broadcasts, and aiming to help give back to the community that has already given us so much. And although we will not be holding a funding drive, we are always accepting donations via our website, cfru.ca, or in person from anyone who still wants to contribute. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children. Victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. And we have, brothers and sisters, we have come down to the last show of the year. I'm actually taking next week off, and I'm going to be going back to air again on January the 2nd, 2016. So this is the last show I'm going to be doing live to air here in 2015. And I'm going to get right into it because there's a lot to talk about. You know, I'm going to get into a little more about what's going on in Venezuela. I talked a little bit about that last week. But I really want to talk about a little bit about Syria here tonight. And I'm going to try to tie that in to some certain political goings on in this country. You know, we see the kind of Trudeau mania, I guess you could kind of call it, which, frankly really gets on my nerves. It really drives me mental to see a, newly elected capitalist state leader, be lionized like this in the media. It really does not impress me, the kind of grandstanding he's engaged in recently with his kind of photo ops with Syrian refugees in particular, his appearing in Vogue magazine, you know, people calling him the sexiest man alive and all this other nonsense, which I think is just, you know, obscures the real issues in our society and the real issues that are occurring around the world today, which we really need to pay attention to. Now, with regard to the Syrian refugees, I'm going to start with that. Really, the Syrian refugees, of course, he's been engaged in, you know, massive amount of photo ops and stuff, welcoming them to Canada and you know, treating them to all kinds of, like, Canadian cultural events and stuff like that to, quote-unquote, you know, assimilate them into Canadian society. The Syrian refugees are kind of like the Aboriginal Australian football player that John Pilger, the Australian journalist John Pilger, interviewed in his documentary Welcome to Australia about the racism in Australian sport. He said that when you're on the field kicking goals, people all want to know you. But off the field, it's a different story. You know, and we see very strong parallels with what's going on with Syrian refugees in Canada right now. Syrian refugees are in the limelight now. You know, this is a major media story. You know, and Trudeau sees a brilliant photo op moment that he can take advantage of. But where are those refugees going to be when the cameras go away? Where are they going to be in 1 year's time? Will these people have decent living? Will they have decent housing? Will they have decent jobs? Will they even have a job? Will they even have citizenship? We have to remember that spectacle doesn't put food on the table for people. You know, and photo ops are not the same as justice. And this is crucial to remember. I was actually in a march when I was up in Ottawa visiting friends last week. I was in a march in support of Canadian refugees, of refugees who come to Canada from Syria and other countries, who often do face discrimination, they face racism in this society, which of course was built upon imperialism and colonial seizure of Aboriginal land. You know, I was in support of this. I was marching in support of these people. You know, and I was there. I was with many other communists in the Ottawa region, whether that's in the Communist Party, the Young Communist League, or the Revolutionary Student Movement, were also there. And, you know, we were there, we were standing in solidarity, as is our internationalist duty as communists, to stand up for these people who are facing the brunt of reactionary aggression in the world today. And seeing that the Canadian government played a significant role in driving the conflict in Syria, whether that's bombing or supporting various militant groups on the ground with training activities and stuff like that to destabilize the situation in Syria, seeing that they did a lot to create the situation as it now stands on the ground, which people are having to run from, having to flee from for their lives, you know, to try to get away. You know, the government of Canada, no one in the government of Canada has any right to now act like they are a moral authority when they played this role in creating the situation in the first place, that these refugees had to leave their homeland and come to Canada. You know, Trudeau or anybody else in his government has no business, you know, acting like, you know, Canada is some sort of city on the hill. You know, this moral authority that everyone in the world looks to. It's not like that at all. And we cannot let our view be obscured by the kind of propaganda that we're seeing right now that Trudeau is really putting out there and really hamming up in front of the cameras right now. But needless to say, the war on Syria is an act of imperialist aggression. And very tragically, there are people who are using, and I've talked about this before on the show, who are trying to use humanitarian grounds to fuel the fire of imperialism, to get the West to intervene in Syria militarily, and who try to demonize the Syrian government any chance they get in order to get the intervention they want from the West. Not that this is anything new, but I'm going to introduce a new, maybe, feature on this program now, which might become a regular thing, maybe not. It's called Imperialist of the Week. And the Imperialist of the Week, who I'm going to profile right now, is her name is Zeyna Edirham. She's a Syrian-born BBC employee who went back to Syria after the war began to become a spokesman for the so-called opposition, i.e. imperialist pawns in her home country. Her latest tweets, she tweets a lot, she has a major presence on social media. Her latest tweets were about how ISIS is supposedly better than the Syrian government. She's been making the rounds with Western media, the CBC included, about the need for the West to intervene militarily against the Syrian government, selling war against her own country in the name of quote-unquote human rights, appealing to bleeding hearts with the message that the women of Syria in particular need to be saved from their own government, and that the American Empire needs to step in as the savior, just as it supposedly did in Afghanistan in 2001, when liberal feminists declared a crusade against the Taliban and declared that the emancipation of Afghan women would come through American bombs. Of course, the situation for Afghan women, in fact, only worsened after the U.S.-led war on their country began. You know, as they fell prey to rapists and marauding gangs, they faced increased violence, not less violence, after the U.S. intervened and bombed their country and intervened and put soldiers on the ground. And this was also the case in Iraq, Libya, and now in Syria, where women are in fact taking up arms and joining the Syrian Arab Army and various Kurdish militias and self-defense organizations in order to defend themselves and their country from Washington's chosen proxies and contra forces, i.e. the so-called moderate opposition, whose specialty is, of course, chopping heads and crucifying people and doing all the, devouring human flesh and organs and generally doing all the kinds of things which, they're, all the horrific things which, needless to say, are not solely conducted by ISIS. Just about every armed group in Syria on the so-called opposition has committed the most incredible atrocities imaginable. And yet they're the ones who are lionized by people like Zeyna as the people who should be in power in Syria. They're the ones who get, and of course people like Zeyna and people in the Western media give them all kinds of coverage, favorable coverage, and of course the governments in the West, the imperialist powers of the West, give them all manner of guns, training, and backup, as they have done in many other times and places. Of course, imperialist apologists like Zeyna don't say anything about the heroic women of Syria who actually are taking up arms and resisting the proxies of imperialism in their country. In the end, she is just another westernized emigre with an upper-class English accent who patronizingly claims to know what is best for, quote-unquote, her people. And what she wants is curiously identical with what Washington wants. And funny how that always seems to, it always seems to work that way. Her lies are about as bad as British MP Hillary Benn's comments during the British Parliament debate on the bombing of Syria about a week or so ago, when he compared NATO, the NATO bombing of Syria, to the international brigades in the Spanish Civil War. We have a social democrat in the British Parliament trying to claim that bombing Syria you know, these imperialist forces bombing Syria is like. He's trying to link that with the international volunteers going to Spain to fight against fascism in the 1930s, who went generally against the wishes of their governments. You know, Britain, France, the United States, Canada, all these places were backing Franco in Spain, backing the fascists in Spain, you know, tacitly, or even providing them, in some cases, guns and fuel and all kinds of things like that, and not doing a thing when Nazi Germany and fascist Italy intervened in the conflict on the fascist side. They didn't do anything to support the volunteers of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade or the Mackenzie Papineau Brigade or any of the other international brigades who came from places like Canada and the States and Ireland and France and Britain and all kinds of other places to fight against fascism in Spain. Their governments basically stabbed them in the back. Only the Soviet Union stood with the Republican forces, the anti-fascist forces in Spain. And yet, here we have this British MP daring to compare the two, to compare anti-fascist resistance in Spain with bombing a sovereign country, Syria, in the present day. All of these people who suppose, who want to intervene in Syria on supposedly humanitarian grounds to quote-unquote protect people, are frankly monstrous tools of empire and who facilitate the exploitation and destruction of whole nations. You know, and I gave you a whole list of a list of nations there with Afghanistan and Libya and Iraq. You know, Iraq, where, of course, all kinds of false intelligence was fed from Iraqi exiles to the U.S. government to encourage them to attack Iraq. You know, these people fulfill this imperialist role in just about every modern conflict. You know, paving the way for Western imperialism to intervene in their countries of origin. These people are traitors, plain and simple. And they have the blood of their people on their hands. And yes, they do need to be stopped. So I'm going to play a real song of internationalist solidarity with the anti-fascist forces in the Spanish Civil War right now. Maybe Hillary Benn should listen to this song. Maybe it'd be an education for him. I don't know. But this is actually by a East German singer, Ernst Busch, and this is Holstand, Rotes Berlin, Madrid.
Holstand, Rotes Madrid!
Holstand, Rotes Madrid! Holstand, Rotes Madrid! Das Welt voll Brüt, die Menschheit blüht, hier wird mal singt dein Heldenlied, Millionen singen mit. Holstand, Rotes Madrid!
Und schicken dir die Faschisten auch ihre Söldner ins Land. Sie alle werden zerbrechen an deinem Widerstand.
Halsstand, Rotes Madrid! Halsstand, Schwarzes Madrid! Das Weltall brüllt, die Menschheit blüht, wir
wollen sie uns verwehren, an deiner Seite zu sein. Die kühnsten Kämpfer auf Erden marschieren in deinen Reihen.
Halsstand, Rotes Madrid! Halsstand, Schwarzes Madrid! Das Weltall brüllt, die Menschheit blüht, die wir hier fallen sind.
Millionen singen mit. Deutschland,
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM. That was Ernst Busch, Hauptstadt, Rotes Madrid, you know, in solidarity, the song which he did in solidarity with the anti-fascist fighters in the Spanish Civil War. But I want to go back, just very briefly, I want to go back to the issue of these émigrés from these countries that have been targeted by Western imperialism. You know, such as Syria, such as Iraq, such as Libya, such as Afghanistan, these émigrés who facilitate, who basically facilitate imperialism in their own countries by backing and encouraging and giving support to the forces of empire. You know, and that's, of course, I just talked about Zeina Erham and how she's doing that in Syria. And it's very interesting. A parallel needs to be drawn here, in fact, to the dissidents in the Soviet Union and some of the various tactics they used to try to undermine the Soviet government in the 1970s and 1980s in particular. None of these dissident organizations, and I'm mostly going to draw upon Albert Szymanski's book, Human Rights in the Soviet Union, with regard to this, none of these dissidents actually had, whether that's Andrei Sakharov or Alexander Solzhenitsyn or any of these people, none of these people had like really any popular support at all amongst the various peoples of the Soviet Union. And because basically, regardless of their intentions, Soviet dissidents functioned as little more than proxies for the CIA. As Albert Szymanski points out, the tactics employed by dissidents in the USSR were deliberately aimed at garnering sympathy in the West while undermining the moral credibility and international image of the world's first socialist state. And this is a quote. Dissidents frequently engage in actions with the expectation of being detained and perhaps sentenced in order to create martyrs whom they know will be celebrated in the West, thus bringing external pressure on the Soviet regime. The result that it was that even pitifully small protests and demonstrations within the Soviet Union were treated as major news by the Western media, which celebrated these occasions as, quote, as signs of the lack of freedom and existence of domestic discontent. That is of weakness in the Soviet socialism. Dissidents actively collaborated with Western media and intelligence agencies, with émigrés supplying anti-Soviet radio, particularly Radio Liberty and Voice of America, with material that could be broadcast back into the Soviet Union. Dissidents regularly held press conferences with foreign journalists, conducted television interviews with Western media, worked with Western NGOs like Amnesty International, while making direct appeals to the UN and even the US Congress and European Security Conference in support of anti-Soviet political and economic measures. Andrei Sakharov actually appealed to the US Senate in support of the Jackson Amendment restricting US trade with the USSR, thus attempting to economically sabotage his own country in collusion with a hostile imperial power. And see, actions like these reveal something about the character of most Soviet dissidents who, in spite of the relative tolerance of the authorities in the Soviet Union by the 1970s, were never able to mobilize any significant degree of support among the peoples of the Soviet Union until Mikhail Gorbachev deliberately created a political constituency for them in the closing years of its existence. Prior to this, dissidents had effectively given up on mobilizing Soviet public opinion and had basically opted to sabotage the USSR in collaboration with foreign powers. As Albert Szymanski notes, conscious of the considerable interest of the Western capitalist countries in the Soviet Union, an interest based on hostility to its social, political, and economic organizations, and the threat that growing Soviet influence represents to Western capitalism, especially in the less developed countries, the dissidents attempt to mobilize them in support of their goals. The traditionalist right, such as Solzhenitsyn, explicitly endeavors to undermine the legitimacy of socialism, strengthen its enemies, hinder its spread, and strengthen the military might of the US and NATO. The liberals, by encouraging Western governments, especially the US, to restrict trade, cultural and scientific contacts, nuclear disarmament, etc., attempt to pressure the Soviets into conceding their dissident demands for liberalization. While the left, by appealing to foreign communists and progressive intellectuals to exert pressure through their contacts and media, hope to harness the Soviet desire for smooth relations with leftist forces around the world to their cause. All of these dissidents effectively sought to enhance the soft power of the capitalist West and its war against the Soviet Union and the forces of international socialism. You know. And as we see around the world with the various countries that are targeted by Western imperialism today, you know, Syria is the most notable one right now, you know, we see these kind of Western dissidents or opposition forces who are basically mobilized in support of Western goals in Syria. So these Syrian opposition forces are over there. They have the limelight, they have the spotlight, they have the media, they have like all the support in the world to try to demonize the Syrian government in any way they can and to push for Western intervention. And the same thing, of course, happened in Iraq and the same thing happened in Libya. You have these exile communities who push for imperialist intervention in their respective homelands and hope to become the governing forces, the governing power, you know, the power structure that comes into power after the forces of imperialism have intervened. Now, if there is any group of people in the world who deserve to be called traitors, it would be them. Who basically seek to have no problem with like Western imperialism coming in, basically wrecking and destroying their countries of origin, so long as they become the power behind the throne that the West installs as their compliant puppets after the intervention is complete. You know, these people are despicable human beings. And frankly, the Soviet dissidents played the same role in Russia. You know, these are basically tools of imperialism, and I have no tolerance for them. I have zero tolerance for them. And seeing I talked about Trudeau before, let's just paraphrase Trudeau, some of the, you know, the famous words he said during the October crisis. Remember what he said? You know, all those bleeding hearts can go on and bleed, you know, but it's better to oppose imperialism. And of course, maybe someone will ask me one day, how far are you willing to take your anti-imperialist struggle, Mr. Siegfried Berezov? And I will say, well, just watch me. Imperialism has to be stopped, and it has to be stopped through any means necessary. So with that, here's a rather jovial little song from Ireland, which produces many, you know, of course, Irish movement for self-determination, the revolutionary movement in Ireland, anti-colonial struggle in Ireland against British colonialism, has produced many anti-imperialist anthems, and this is one of those, but really, you know, the sentiments are effectively universal amongst those people who fight against empire. You know, whether they're in Syria or whether they're in Iraq or anywhere in the world. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. This is the Wolf Tones from, with their song Rock On, Rock All.
The empire is finished, now foreign lands to seize. So the greedy eye of England is turning towards the seas. 200 miles from Donegal, there's a place that's called Rockall, and the groping hands of Whitehall grabbing at its walls.
Oh, Rockall, Rockall, you never fall. Father Britain's greedy hands, are you meet the same resistance like you did in many lands? May the seagulls rise above your eyes, and the water crush your shell, and the natural gas will burn your ass, blow you all to hell.
This rock is part of Ireland, for it's written in folklore. Finn McCool took a sod of grass, he threw it to the fore. Then he tossed the pebble across the sea. Wherever did it fall? For the sun became the Isle of Man. The pebbles called Rockall.
Oh, Rockall, Rockall, you never fall. Father Britain's greedy hands, are you meet the same resistance like you did in many lands? May the seagulls rise above your eyes,
and the water crush your shell, and the natural gas will burn your ass and blow you all to hell.
All the seas will not be silent while Britannia grabs the waves. Remember that the Irish will no longer be your slaves. Remember that Britannia, well, she rules the waves no more. Keep your hands up, rock all, it's Irish to the core.
Oh, rock on, rock all, you'll never fall. Father Britain's greedy hands, or you meet the same resistance like you did in many lands. May the seagulls rise above your eyes, and the water crush your shell, and the natural gas will burn your ass and blow you all to hell. Oh, rock on, rock all, you'll never fall. Father Britain's greedy hands, or you meet the same resistance like you did in many lands. May the seagulls rise above your eyes, and the water crush your shell, and the natural gas will burn your ass, blow you all to hell.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And another place where, of course, we see resistance to imperialism today is in Venezuela. I talked about the situation in Venezuela last week and with regard to the election and the fact that the opposition, the pro-Western, pro-imperialist opposition, basically, managed to win the recent parliamentary elections in that country. But I want to really emphasize to you, of course, the Bolivarian Revolution, the struggle that the working people in Venezuela have been waging, really since 1998, even before then, with resistance against neoliberalism. That struggle is not over, you know, by any means. You know, like, this is not the end, you know, as some pessimistic people have actually recently said. You know, after the results of the election came in, many people have basically said, like, oh, it's game over. You know, the progressive forces in Venezuela have lost. But this is not the case. And I want to read an article by Eric Dreitzer, who's an anti-imperialist activist from the States. And he was in Venezuela during the elections. And he wrote this article called Venezuela, a Revolution That Will Not Die. And this is what he says. This is not a revolution that can be undone with one election, nor can it be simply legislated out of existence. Much has been written about the outcome of Venezuela's December 6th legislative elections, with many of the analyses justifiably focusing on the shortcomings of the Socialist Party and the difficulty of the current state of affairs in the country. Indeed, even before the political body was cold, post-mortem examinations abounded in the corporate and alternative media with dissections of seemingly every aspect of the Bolivarian Republic's political, economic, and social life. These elections still saw more than 5 million Venezuelans cast votes for the PSUV, the Socialist Party of Venezuela, and the Revolution for Socialism and Anti-Imperialism. But what these journalists and political analysts often overlook is the determination of the core of the Bolivarian Revolution, the radical base that is committed to preserving what Hugo Chavez began building more than 17 years ago. This is not a revolution that can be undone with one election, nor can it simply be legislated out of existence. This revolution will not, as some cynics have argued, be brought down by the weight of its own contradictions, or by internal rot and corruption, or by external forces such as assassinations and economic destabilization. Instead, the revolution will survive. It will be resurgent. It will be reborn thanks to the commitment of millions of dedicated Chavistas. While one may take this as an article of faith, it is instead a conclusion born of experience in Venezuela, one that is informed by dozens of conversations with activists and organizers whose words of love and dedication to the revolution are matched only by their actions to build it. In building the revolution, these men, women, and children are pledged to defend it. The election results and the social problems from which they sprang are undeniably a comment on the level of discontent that many Venezuelans feel, both towards their government and the general state of affairs in the country. To read the corporate media, one would think that this is the end for the Bolivarian Revolution. The defeat of the polls is a repudiation of the entire program of the PSUV and its allied political parties. But such a reading belies the reality and resilience of the revolutionary process, one that has been, that has seen and overcome great challenges before. In April 2002, the U.S.-backed opposition in Venezuela staged a coup against then-President Chavez in a desperate attempt to reassert their control over the country and extinguish the Bolivarian Revolution. Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans poured into the streets of Caracas, with millions more in other parts of the country calling for Chavez to be restored to his rightful office and for the coup leaders to be arrested. There was really no doubt that the U.S. was responsible for this attempt at forced regime change, with many mainstream news outlets reporting within days that high-ranking officials in the Bush administration were intimately involved in orchestrating the coup. Although it may seem like a mere historical footnote, 13 years later, the failed coup was a watershed moment in Venezuela, a proving ground for the revolution, when the people for whom Chavez and the Bolivarian process meant a better... When the people for whom Chavez and the Bolivarian process meant a better future dared to challenge U.S. hegemony and the attempted reestablishment of political power by the capitalist ruling class. But April 2002 represented even more than just resistance to Washington. The restoration of Chavez to power was a demonstration of the steadfastness with which Venezuelans were prepared to defend their revolution from external threats, even ones that until 1998 had seemed omnipotent. It showed that the first, but certainly not the last, it showed for the first, but certainly not for the last time, that the revolution would not and could not be undone by the dirty tricks of the empire and its comprador class inside the country. In the years since 2002, Venezuela has repeatedly been the target of political, economic, and social destabilization by the United States. These coordinated attempts have increased exponentially since the death of Chavez in 2013 and the election of current President Nicolas Maduro. Such subversion has taken many forms, including the use of highly effective and well-planned forms of psychological warfare through the manipulation of media and public opinion. In 2007, author and investigative journalist Eva Gollinger revealed that Washington was funding a program to provide financial support to the Venezuelan journalists hostile to Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution. Indeed, the effort was aimed at influencing public opinion through the right-wing media, shaping the views of Venezuelans against their government. A battle-tested method of destabilization by the CIA. Such tactics of psychological warfare were documented in the CIA's Psychological Operations and Guerrilla Warfare, a manual distributed to the Contras in Nicaragua as Washington attempted to bring down the Sandinista government in the 1980s. As noted here, the CIA wanted to determine the needs, quote, the needs and frustration of the target groups and create a generalized anti-government hostility. The objective was to create the false impression in the minds of the population that the government was the, quote, the cause of their frustration. This has been done to great effect in Venezuela. The right-wing media in the country has done everything in its power to undermine the government and heap all the blame onto the PSUV, including for the effects of the economic war waged against it. According to the right-wing media, it is President Maduro and the entire government, along with the movement that they represent, that has created and exacerbated all of these problems with ineptitude and failed policies. While undoubtedly mistakes have been made, it is equally true that many of the major problems in the country were compounded by economic sabotage. The salient point here, though, is that an economic war is transformed into a psychological war, one that figured prominently in recent elections. Indeed, the economic war is critical to understanding the current state of the country. In the wake of the opposition's victory at the polls, basic goods started magically reappearing on store shelves in Venezuela. Yet another indication that much of the scarcity in recent months can be attributed not to the failed economic policies, but rather to a coordinated campaign of economic subversion and sabotage. Similarly, some of the problems of inflation and sale of contraband can directly be attributed to the U.S.-backed opposition and to its patrons in Miami and Washington. This is certainly not to absolve the government of all the blame, but rather to point out that Venezuela and its revolution have been directly targeted by the forces of the empire. The destabilization of the country is also very much overt, with assassinations playing a key role. Perhaps no targeted killing has had a greater impact on the country and the revolution than the 2014 assassination of Robert Serra, a young, up-and-coming legislator from the PSUV who was murdered by individuals connected to former Colombian president and self-declared enemy of the Bolivarian Revolution, Álvaro Uribe. A young, photogenic, and deeply committed activist and legislator, Serra was seen by many as the future of the PSUV and of the Chavista movement in the country. His murder was interpreted by millions as a direct assault on the revolution and the future of the country. Walking through the radical working-class neighborhoods of 23 January and El Valle, one is likely to find posters and or graffiti scrawled on the walls with the simple phrase, Robert vive, Robert lives, and the iconic image of the young Serra, the future of the revolution, gunned down before he even had a chance to lead. And this is the reality of the revolution. The U.S. and its proxies have done everything in their power to destroy the Bolivarian process. And yet the revolution carries on. This is more than just a slogan of resistance. It is objective fact. These elections, which took place amid deteriorating economic conditions and intense psychological and economic war, still saw more than 5 million Venezuelans cast their votes for the PSUV and the revolution, for socialism and anti-imperialism. Rumors of Chavismo's demise have been greatly exaggerated. This dream, this revolution, will not die.
Pongo por delante de nosotros al comandante de todos los comandantes, al Cristo Redentor, crucificado y resucitado, al Cristo y su mensaje liberador, al Cristo y su mensaje de amor, de la justicia social, y los llamo a todos. Los que quieran patria, vengan conmigo para que sigamos haciendo patria.
Socialismo, inclusión, solidaridad y vocación, sacrificio, integración, reimpulsando la nación, justicia y revolución, son una misma cuestión. Como el pueblo y el amor, invencible voz de Dios, un compromiso, un corazón.
Socialista Unido de Venezuela, un partido para elevar a su más alta dimensión la patria de Bolívar.
PSV, la fuerza de los pueblos. PSV, la fuerza de los pobres. PSV, de hombres y mujeres. PSV, de los trabajadores. PSV, América Latina. PSV, alerta que camina. PSV, la espada de Bolívar. PSV,
contra la tiranía.
Campesinos, transportistas, militares y milicias, policías y bomberos, comerciantes, misioneros, verdaderos, petroquímicos, científicos y obreros, enfermeras y doctores, ciudadanos, pescadores.
Profesores, estudiantes, barreteros, navegantes, peluqueros, carpinteros, afro-indio, vigilantes, sacerdotes, periodistas, zapateros, los agentes, batallones, brigadistas, vengan, cooperativistas.
PSV, la fuerza de los pueblos. PSV, la fuerza de los pobres. PSV, de hombres y mujeres. PSV, de los trabajadores.
Socialismo, solidaridad, unidad, unidad, la diversidad, victoria de Venezuela, paz, prosperidad, salud, seguridad, unidad latinoamericana, victoria, victoria, victoria de Venezuela.
Militantes del PSV con Chávez, vamos a vencer. Militantes del PSV con Chávez, vamos a vencer. Militantes del PSV con Chávez, vamos a vencer. ¡O muerte! ¡Venceremos!
Hi, I'm Braden.
Lana.
Ira.
Svieta.
Tanya.
Elliot.
Chantal.
And
Oksana.
Sonana.
Joel.
Emma.
Jimmy. Dima.
Amara.
And we're Canada World Youth.
And you're listening to 93.3 FM CFRU.
I'm really looking forward to the Writers' Workshop again this year on February 18th and 19th. Are you going?
I've never been. What is it?
It's a free, two-day, physically accessible event at the University of Guelph's McLaughlin Library, where writing experts provide workshops on tons of different areas of writing. Fiction, social media, research publishing, screenwriting. There really is something for everyone, even food and travel writing.
Can anyone attend?
Yes, it's open to the public.
That sounds amazing. And it's free. I could use some help with my blogging and tweeting for sure.
Let's check out the news section at lib.uoguelph.ca and choose our sessions. Then, we can be the first to register on January 12th so we don't miss out.
Register for this year's Writers' Workshop taking place February 18th and 19th. There's something for everyone.
Êtes-vous francophone ou francophile?
CFRU is looking for French-speaking volunteers to start or contribute to French language programming on the station. Le genre du programme est à vous, que ce soit sur les actualités, la justice sociale ou les arts, la meilleure émission sera sur un sujet dont vous êtes passionné. Nous offrons la formation gratuite en technologie et production des médias.
Envoyez un message avec votre nom et coordonnées à Brian par courriel à polylingual@commercialcfru.ca pour devenir bénévole dans cette nouvelle radio collective. Apportez votre voix à CFRU 93.3 FM, la radio communautaire de Guelph.
The Guelph Wellington Sex Workers Action Group engages community organizations, public agencies, and individuals with lived experience in a collaborative effort to improve the systems and conditions that marginalize sex workers in Guelph and Wellington County. SWAG works in solidarity with individuals working in sex work towards our vision of a healthier, safer, respected, and better world. Also, please join us Thursday, December 17th, between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. in St. George's Square for our event in support of International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. You can find us by the red umbrellas, ready to greet you with smiles, resources, and swag bags. For more information or to learn how to become involved, check us out on Facebook under Sex Workers Action Group Guelph or contact Sarah Wilmer, Women's Community Development Coordinator, at 519-763-2255, extension 161. Sex Workers Action Group looks forward to collaborating with you.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So before the break, we just heard a piece of music from the PSUV, actually, in the Socialist Party of Venezuela, which is engaging, actually, right now in a process of self-criticism and actually really trying to reconnect with the grassroots of the movements that in the communes and in the various in the communities, in the barrios, in the various the real base of the party, in the working class of Venezuela. It's really trying to see the mistakes that it made in the past, and it's really trying to build itself for the future. In some ways, its electoral loss was a blessing in disguise in the fact that it managed to basically come to an understanding that they really need to press class struggle in Venezuela a lot harder than they have. There really is no room for complacency when they're up against an enemy like the opposition coalition, which is American backed and American funded, and is willing to use terror tactics and assassinations and all manner of things in order to destabilize the country and undermine socialism in Venezuela. The PSUV increasingly understands it has to mobilize the masses. It has to reconnect with the masses, remain accountable to the masses. And really, if it wants to win, if it wants to continue developing socialism in Venezuela, it has to really step up its game in a real meaningful way. And that does mean, once again, that means democracy. That means getting the opportunist, careerist elements out of the party and, focusing on, putting the needs of the people first, and doing what they want. And fulfilling their demands, and using those demands to better themselves, self-criticism, self-improvement of the party as an organization. And they're doing that. And they're passing laws to protect the rights of workers, which are under threat now because the opposition is taking control of the parliament and has openly said it wants to do away with various progressive legislation that has been put forward in past years. With regard to workers and with regard to job security and wages and what have you, So the government is moving very strongly to defend the rights of workers in Venezuela right now. So there's a lot of very positive things that are actions, which the PSUV, even though it lost the election, is still taking right now. And really, I see that as a very positive way forward. And it's definitely reinvigorated the base of the PSUV, and they're definitely advancing. They're fighting harder now. Because they realize they have to. So, of course, I was talking about Trudeau earlier and the kind of grandstanding he's engaged in recently. And the closest parallel to him and the various politics which he is following and the kind of image that he's projecting right now or striving to project in the media and around the world, it's really similar to what Obama was trying to do in 2008 after he got elected in 2009, and the kind of mystique which he tried to portray as the first black president of the United States, and as it supposedly, everybody wanted to believe he was progressive. Everybody wanted to believe he had something to offer that was radically different from George Bush. And it's really similar to what we have in with regard to Trudeau. Everybody wants to believe he's radically different from Stephen Harper. And he is, and that him coming to power is almost like this kind of, transformative moment in Canadian politics. They want to believe that. But ultimately, the evidence is not there for that. Once again, we see him hand in glove with imperialism around the world, hand in glove with the capitalist class, hand in glove with the establishment and the status quo, and which precludes him doing anything remotely radical. And these kind of illusions that ultimately will be shattered, and they must be shattered if people are to go forward and actually build a truly progressive future. They cannot allow themselves to get hung up on people like him and the kind of image that they portray and put out there, this kind of savior image. It's not something we can allow ourselves to get hung up on. So I'm going to play a an amazing talk, actually, by John Pilger, which he gave in 2009, not long after Obama came to power and came into office. And there was still a major amount of mystique around him. But of course, as we saw, as time went on, he didn't make life better for black people in America. That's why black people have Black Lives Matter now and are standing up against police killings, because he did not save them. You know, he did not, frankly, do anything to better their condition. You know, and the same thing, like having a African-American Secretary of Justice in charge of the Justice Department and stuff like that did not do anything to protect African-Americans.